From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a plan for Burkina Faso's transitional government. Latest on the Ebola outbreak, Islamic State leader wounded, plus the APEC summit getting underway in Beijing. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The political opposition, civil society groups, and religious leaders Sunday adopted a plan for a transitional authority in Burkina Faso more than a week after longtime President Blaise Compaoré was forced from power. Burkinabe politician Benawende Sankara said the document contains the values of the West African country's constitution, but added others included integrity, dignity to ensure the country is tolerant, peace and stability are restored. Military remains in control of government and appointed Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zeta as its head of state. Army is under pressure from the regional group ECOWAS and the African Union to return control to civilian authority in 2 weeks or face sanctions. On Sunday, dozens of officials meeting in Ouagadougou called for creation of a 90-member transitional parliament, including representatives of the army, political opposition, civil society, and other groups, including Mr. Compaoré's political allies, leading to elections next November. It also creates a special group to select a transitional president next year. None of the current interim leaders would be allowed to stand for election. The plan is being submitted now to the military for its approval. In an interview from exile in Ivory Coast, Mr. Compaoré accused the opposition of plotting a coup with the army. 63-year-old Mr. Compaoré, forced to flee after trying to extend his rule, took power in a coup in 1987. In Equatorial Guinea, a country ruled since 1979 by Teodoro Obiang Nguema, the media has been banned from mentioning the revolt in Burkina Faso. And here in Washington, U.S. officials continue to evaluate whether a coup took place in Burkina Faso last month, and the determination is made that would result in an automatic suspension of military aid. A U.S. spokesperson Friday said Washington is following the lead of ECOWAS and the AU on the matter. The French press agency reports that while the Ebola epidemic seems to be slowing across West Africa, northeastern Sierra Leone continues to grapple with new cases. An estimated 50 people have died in Ouagadougou since mid-October, according to the Red Cross. Some 60 cases of the deadly virus have been confirmed in the region, and at least 200 people are currently under quarantine. Fore Jallo, chief of the Niani region, told the Red Cross last Wednesday that several bodies were left for days on village streets as people were too afraid to touch the bodies. In the hardest-hit country, Liberia, rates of infection are down in the capital, Monrovia, but the disease's epicenter has shifted north to the county of Grand Cape Mount. James Jallapaul is a resident of Jendawande.
We are afraid of Ebola now. Because Ebola could damage people, so everybody is afraid, everybody is scared. So if somebody is sick, nobody can go around there. So begging upon the government to come to our rescue. When the government come to our rescue, we'll finish it, our people will finish. There will be empty space.
Nearly 2,800 people in Liberia have died of Ebola since March. Meantime, the African Union, the African Development Bank, and regional business leaders have set up a crisis fund to help areas hit hard by Ebola. Meeting in Ethiopia Saturday, they pledged to offer more than $28 million to help respond to the deadly virus. And according to the World Health Organization, the latest figures now, Ebola has infected more than 13,000 people in 8 countries. Nearly 5,000 have died. Although the Ebola crisis may have abated somewhat, the fight containing the epidemic to contain it and help its victims is continuing. At a press conference in New York, Nicole Walden of the International Rescue Committee offered an update. Adam Phillips reports.
In the U.S. government's Foreign Press Center next to the United Nations, Nicole Walden told reporters about the IRC's multi-pronged efforts to fight Ebola in Liberia.
It has ranged from investigating cases to identifying contacts that may have interacted with infected individuals and tracing those individuals for the 21-day incubation period. We've supported the establishment of infection prevention and control mechanisms within the health facilities around the country.
Walden explained that most of Liberia's health facilities closed when the epidemic began to rage out of control earlier this year.
People were too afraid. The health workers themselves had no confidence in their ability to keep themselves safe. And so health services have basically ceased to exist in the form of malaria or antenatal support, pneumonia until very recently. A number of health facilities' doors have reopened because of the support provided in training healthcare workers how to keep themselves safe.
Powerful clashes between traditional African culture and Western epidemiology have complicated fighting Ebola. In African culture, a corpse is handled by many loving hands before it is buried. But health workers know that direct contact with fluids from an infected body spreads the virus.
In the county where Monrovia sits, a couple of months ago, the situation was at such a critical level that it was decided to stop burials and make mandatory cremation for all dead bodies. This was extremely, extremely unpopular, disconcerting for families. It flies in the face of every cultural norm and tradition that people have. While some communities, you could get them on board with the science of it, but couldn't reconcile the emotion of it. We are exploring all options. How could we go back to burial practice? Where is a safe location? How can we make sure that safe burials can be possible again? I think that will be happening imminently.
When asked whether the outbreak in Liberia may be getting under control, Walden offered a measured response. She said transmission rates do seem to be declining, but warned against complacency.
I think we're in a place now where this is far, far beyond a public health crisis. This is affecting every aspect of life, from the economy. Schools are closed. No education is happening. People are struggling to find jobs and don't have access to other types of health services. So people are affected. Their mental health, their social and emotional well-being and care is really starting to get highlighted as part of the response, something that hasn't been given enough attention to date. We need to redouble our efforts, not only in thinking about the medical activities and interventions that need to take place, but a really holistic way of looking at the new normal.
Containment and treatment clinics paid for by the United States and its allies continue to be built in Liberia and other West African nations where the epidemic is most severe. Meanwhile, Ebola-related deaths continue, especially in remote rural areas where access even to rudimentary health care is scarce to non-existent. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And as we just heard from the IRC representative, safe burial procedures are considered key to reducing the transmission of Ebola. The WHO says it has developed new burial protocols, which are in line with the cultural and religious beliefs of Ebola-infected communities in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. Lisa Schlein has more from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says the majority of Ebola infections in West Africa occur during unsafe burials. This is because a person killed by Ebola is most contagious right after he or she dies. WHO Ebola expert Pierre Formenti says burial rites that require directly touching or washing the body make family and community members vulnerable to contracting the Ebola virus.
During the months of August, I think we were close to 60% of the transmission due to burial. Now, thanks to the development and the creation of many burial teams in the three countries, we have decreased this number down to around 30. What was important with this new guideline is to introduce not only safe techniques, but also techniques of burial that will be accepted religiously by the different community, by the different families, by the different villages, and by the people.
Over the past few weeks, the WHO, working with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies and a number of faith-based organizations, updated the burial protocols to take into account the cultural and religious sensibilities of West African families and communities. Dr. Formenti says these discussions resulted in measures that allow families of the bereaved to perform sacred rites in a safe manner.
If you do a safe burial but without the dignity to the person who are dying, then the next family will refuse to accept the burial team, and then, of course, the transmission will augment.
Sally Smith, a community mobilization advisor at the UNAIDS agency, says there is no single blueprint for holding a dignified burial ceremony. She says it varies widely among different communities. Therefore, she says it is very important to ask people what is important for them and then figure out how this particular rite can be carried out in a safe way.
One of the things that was important for the Islamic community particularly was that the person was not buried naked. And that was the idea of then bringing a white cloth that could be laid on top of the body bag so that then when the body was placed on the body bag, the cloth could be folded over like a shroud. Again, for the Christian community, it was maybe reading a scripture verse. They may want to write that scriptural verse and put that inside the body bag with the person or put a cross inside.
The WHO says it expects to reach about 70% safe burials in the Ebola-infected countries by December. While this will certainly reduce the transmission of the virus, it says safe burial practices are not enough to curb the epidemic. It says efforts must continue to isolate Ebola victims in treatment centers and to trace the contacts of those infected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And for an up-to-date report on what's happening with the Ebola outbreak, check out our website at voanews.com. On the homepage, there is a special link to our special coverage.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Senior Iraqi officials are reporting that the leader of the Islamic State militants, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has been wounded in an airstrike. Earlier on Sunday, Britain's chief of defense staff, Nick Houghton, said in a BBC television interview that even if Baghdadi were killed, he would not rush to the conclusion that it would be a strategic reverse for the insurgents.
Can't absolutely confirm that Baghdadi has been killed. Even the Americans themselves are not yet in a position to do that. Probably it will take some days to have absolute confirmation.
Sure.
What I wouldn't want to do is sort of rush to the sense that the potential death of one of their totemic leaders is going to create some strategic reverse within ISIS. They will regenerate leadership. It's because of the current potential attractiveness of this warped ideology, unless we get the political dimension of the strategy in place, then ISIS has the potential to keep regenerating and certainly regenerating its leaders.
Iraq, without elaborating, said Baghdadi was injured in the American airstrike, but U.S. officials didn't confirm it. In Washington, President Obama said airstrikes have been very effective in degrading the jihadist capabilities and slowing their advance. He said his deployment of an additional 1,500 U.S. troops to Iraq to train Baghdad's military marks a new phase in the fight against the Islamic State group. Mr. Obama said the doubling of the American troop level will help Iraq go on some defense, offense that is, but repeated his stance that U.S. troops will not engage in ground fighting. Negotiators from the U.S., Iran, as well as the EU, holding a second day of high-level talks in Oman today on the future of Iran's nuclear program. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, and EU negotiator Catherine Ashton are working to resolve differences ahead of a November deadline. VOA's Pam Dawkins has the story.
Secretary of State Kerry, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, and EU negotiator Ashton smiled but made no comment to reporters about the talks as they opened their session on Sunday. But as he traveled to Oman, Zarif did say that he thought the most important issues that needed to be discussed were uranium enrichment and sanctions.
It is important for the West to understand that sanctions have never contributed to the resolution of this issue. Sanctions are not a part of the solution. Sanctions are the most important part of the problem.
Negotiators are working against a November 24th deadline to balance Iran's desire to enrich uranium for fuel and Western concerns that Iran is trying to make nuclear weapons. Speaking on the CBS program Face the Nation, U.S. President Barack Obama questioned whether the negotiators and Iran would be able to bridge their remaining differences.
Are we going to be able to close this final gap so that they can re-enter the international community, sanctions can be slowly reduced, and we have verifiable, Loctite assurances that they can't develop a nuclear weapon? There's still a big gap. We may not be able to get there.
Kerry, Zarif, and Ashton will sit down for more talks in Oman on Monday. The talks are expected to continue on Tuesday at the political director's level. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Oman.
White House voiced grave concern on Sunday over reports of military reinforcements pouring into eastern Ukraine from neighboring Russia, including the cross-border transfer of heavy weapons and tanks. National Security Council spokesperson Bernadette Meehan also warned that any move by pro-Russia rebels to seize more territory in Ukraine's embattled east would be seen as a blatant violation of a ceasefire deal with the Kiev government. Latest U.S. warning comes as European monitors reported convoys of heavy weapons and armor moving into the east along the heavily shelled west rebel-controlled city of Donetsk. Meehan also urged both sides to fully honor commitments to the September truce, particularly Moscow's promise to stop the cross-border flow of troops, weapons, and supplies. Russian President Vladimir Putin met on Sunday with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Beijing ahead of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Leaders Summit. Both sides expressed their willingness to work on a peace treaty between the countries. Russia and Japan did not sign a peace treaty after World War II because of an ongoing dispute over islands which both countries claim sovereignty. Chinese President Xi Jinping said that while China's economy is facing challenges, they are not as scary as some may think. In an address to world business leaders on Sunday, Mr. Xi also called for progress in a regional free trade agreement and highlighted China's plans to set up a $40 billion fund for infrastructure development in the region. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
President Xi Jinping says that as China adapts to what he calls a new normal of slower growth and slacking exports, the country's growth rate is still ranked as one of the highest in the world, at about 7%. Mr. Xi says some people worry that China's economy will fall further, or whether it can climb over the next ridge. He says there are indeed risks, but they are not that scary. China's economy slipped to a new low in the third quarter. It is now at the lowest point since the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. Mr. Xi's remarks came at the opening ceremony of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation CEO Leaders Summit. In the address, he noted that as China works to promote an aggressive reform agenda domestically, it has already seen some improvement, such as stronger domestic consumption. He also says there is no turning back for Beijing on a massive reform agenda that was launched late last year. China's president says once the bow is drawn, the arrow cannot be put back in the quiver. He says China is committed to deepening reforms and giving the market more influence in the economy. At the same time China is looking to reform itself, it is also reaching out to deepen economic engagement with the region. Mr. Xi says China will put $40 billion into the establishment of a Silk Road Fund to help with the building up of infrastructure across the region. China is aggressively seeking to strengthen ties with Central Asia through a new Silk Road policy and what it calls a maritime Silk Road route through Southeast Asia and on to South Asia and the Middle East. To help spearhead that effort, it established the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank last month. China's president says that over the next decade, his country's outbound investment will total more than $1 trillion. He also notes that six out of the top 10 destinations for Chinese investment are in Asia. Mr. Xi says that over the next 5 years, China will import over $10 trillion worth of goods, and the number of outbound Chinese tourists will also exceed 500 million. He says that for the Asia-Pacific and the world at large, China's development will generate huge opportunities and benefits. China's big pledges of money, tourists, and engagement are to be expected as a host of APEC and as the country works to ease concerns in the region following months of tensions with Japan and neighbors in the South China Sea over territorial disputes. It also comes as Beijing is increasingly competing for influence with the United States. China is hoping that APEC can push ahead with a regional free trade agreement that aims to bring together what some refer to as a spaghetti bowl of free trade agreements that already exist across the region. At the same time, however, that effort is increasingly seen as competing with Washington's Trans-Pacific Partnership, a regional trade agreement that includes 12 countries, all of which are members of APEC. China has expressed interest in joining the TPP talks, but it currently is not involved. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Vowing to bring order to Uganda's capital, the Kampala Capital City Authority, or KCCA, has been investing in development projects around the city. Elizabeth Pala has more from Kampala.
The KCCA has some serious numbers to boast about. It has repaired more than 150 kilometers of road, doubled trash collection, improved drainage, and revived some schools, healthcare centers, and other social services. However, when trying to crack down on unregulated trade, it has faced considerable pushback. Informal street vendors and market stands make up the majority of trade in Kampala, yet the KCCA has deemed such business activity illegal and has asked vendors to relocate to the trading centers the authority is setting up. Failure to do so can result in fines, confiscation of goods, and jail time. Peter Kaju, the communications manager at the KCCA, explains the crackdown on illegal trading.
We also have a duty of creating more workspaces for the people in the city, and our plan is to come up with such centers in every division. But you know why most people like to stay on the streets is because they make these quick sales and they are not remitting any money anywhere in terms of fees. Because if you're selling on the street, the money they give you, it's not taxed. Where there's change, you expect a bit of resistance, But we are speaking to them, we are encouraging them. We say, yes, you say you have been here for the last 15 years, but you've been doing the wrong thing. There's a better facility the other side.
However, vendors say these market facilities are few, and while they are being built, they must make a living. The KCCA contends these traders are not contributing to the city's development and will continue to face eviction and jail time for breaking the law. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Planet-forming disk orbiting a young star has been captured in detail for the first time by a land-based telescope in Chile. It is expected to give scientists a unique chance to obtain information on how the solar systems form. Our own solar system is assumed to have formed in a similar environment. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. Hope you'll check us out there. Also, the top world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On November 10, 461, Pope Leo I was born. Considered one of the greatest leaders of the Roman Catholic Church, Leo persuaded Attila the Hun to call off an invasion of Italy. On this day in 1483, Martin Luther was born. The German theological scholar and priest sparked the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. In 1775, the first two battalions of Continental Marines were formed in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to serve as a force capable of fighting both at sea and on shore. The units were the predecessors of today's U.S. Marine Corps. On this day in 1871, British-born American journalist Henry Stanley succeeded in finding British explorer and missionary David Livingstone, who was known to be in Africa but had not been heard from for some time. Stanley's 8-month search ended near Lake Tanganyika in present-day Tanzania with, at least according to his own journal, the now famous greeting, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." In 1975, the United Nations passed Resolution 3379, which equated Zionism with racism. The controversial resolution was repealed in 1991. Also in 1975, the freighter, the Edmund Fitzgerald, sank during a storm on Lake Superior along the U.S.-Canadian border, killing all 29 crew on board. In 1985, Bill Gates presented Windows 1.0 to the public. The first in a series of iconic Windows operating systems went on sale a few weeks later on November 20th. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to strengthening ties with the nations of Africa, one of the world's most dynamic and fastest-growing regions. The effort includes a number of programs and initiatives to spur economic growth and underscore America's commitment to Africa's security, democratic development, and economic growth. Tanzania is the second largest economy in East Africa. And with its key location and natural resources, it has the potential for continued growth. Our nation is one of its top five foreign investors, with roughly $950 million a year focused there. President Jakaya Kikwete spoke to U.S. investors and businessmen at an African investment forum held in Washington during the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in August. In October, two U.S. delegations traveled to Tanzania to promote further business development between our two nations. Led by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs David Duckenfield, a group of U.S. investors, entrepreneurs, and philanthropists toured the country to explore investment and trade opportunities with Tanzanian companies and startups. The group, organized under the U.S. State Department's Partnership Opportunity Delegation Initiative, traveled to Dar es Salaam, Bagamoyo, and Zanzibar and discussed potential projects and partnerships with private sector leaders. They also visited with local communities, manufacturers, and small business owners. Also the same month, U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew toured the port of Dar es Salaam to discuss investments in Tanzanian infrastructure projects such as ports, roads, and rail links. These are critical for growth both in Tanzania and throughout the region. Secretary Lew also visited an energy infrastructure site. Inadequate infrastructure has made Tanzania a high-cost business area, investors say. Improvements in port, rail, and road systems could double intra-regional trade in the East African community and boost EAC exports to the U.S. by 40%. U.S. government support for transport and energy infrastructure are key elements to the Trade Africa and Power Africa initiatives launched by President Obama last year. Such U.S. programs are designed to find solutions to challenges in Africa and our partner nations around the world through facilitating effective public-private partnerships.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.